The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Just what makes the English so English? From the obscure traditions of royalty to the mysteries of cricket, Britain offers much to bewilder, perplex, and even alarm even the most enlightened American observer. Sarah Lyle is a correspondent for the New York Times, and if you are a New York Times reader, as well as an LA Times reader, I hope, be that as it is, you will notice that some of the articles that are the most exciting filed from abroad, if you look at the byline, are Sarah's pieces. She's a fantastic correspondent. In the mid-90s, she married a distinguished British editor and settled in her adopted country, and she reports for the New York Times from their London bureau. Her observations on her new relatives and neighbors are the backbone of her funny and occasionally wicked book, The Anglophiles, A Field Guide to the British. You might want to carry Lyle's book with you on an English expedition along with some McVitie's biscuits and a thermos of milk tea. Eric Lacks writes of the author, imagine Margaret Mead channeling John Stewart, and you have Sarah Lyle. Malcolm Gladwell went so far as to recommend that the Anglophiles should be handed out as a public service in the immigration line at Heathrow. Sarah is an American living in London with her British husband. In conversation with Sarah tonight is Frances Anderton, who is an Englishwoman living in LA with her American husband. Frances is the host of DNA, Design and Architecture, aired monthly on 89.9 KCRW, which is our sponsor, co-sponsor tonight. She's also the producer of KCRW's national and local current affairs shows, To the Point and Which Way LA, both hosted by the estimable Warren Olney. In addition, she's the LA editor for Dwell magazine and a contributor to the New York Times and many other publications and books about West Coast design and architecture. So without further ado, please welcome Sarah Lyle and Frances Anderton. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Very nice to see you all here. I think before we start, we should find out who in the room is English and, and who in the room is American, I presume. Everybody else. And who in the room is an Anglophile? And who's an Anglophobe?
There's somebody. He's admitting it.
So when Louise called me and asked if I would come and talk with Sarah, I was so honoured because ever since I've moved here and I've been reading the New York Times and reading Sarah's pieces, I've always thought somehow she just nails it. I mean, as she says herself, the English can be quite opaque, and somehow she has peeled back the layers of very opaque paint there and got under the skin of the British. So I've always really thought her articles were fantastic. So to hear she'd done a book and that I could talk to her about it was very much an honour. And there's also, as Louise just inferred, some small similarities between us. We're about the same age. We have chosen the other side of the Anglo-American relationship to put ourselves. She is married. She's a New Yorker married to a Brit. I'm a Brit married to a New Yorker. We both have small girls. She has two. I have one. Both of whom, probably to each of our horror, is growing up with, in her case, an English accent, and in my case, an American accent. And those accents, those alien accents, sort of seem to completely encapsulate all that can make one feel ambivalent about one's chosen place. But so anyway, with that in mind, we're going to go ahead with our conversation. As Louise said, in about 50 or so minutes, we'll throw open the floor to questions and comments. Sarah will be reading parts of chapters from her book, and we've also got some questions to ask. So do be readying yourselves with your questions and make them witty, since we are talking Britain here. No dull questions need apply. So just to start off with, I assume, because the book's only just come out, that not everybody's had a chance to read it yet. So for those that haven't had a chance to read it yet, but you all will after this evening, you'll buy a copy and Sarah will sign it. This is it, At the Anglophiles, A Field Guide to the British. And you may hear the subtitle, Field Guide, and think, oh, it's a sort of taxonomy of every odd species of Brit that Sarah's observed in her time in England. And I don't think it's exactly that, is it? It's not all the different species. It's not every new face of the immigrants in England. It's not the entire tapestry of English people or personalities. But what it does seem to be is a really fascinating analysis of some of the characteristics and institutions of England that have captured the imagination for centuries, if not decades, among them British attitudes to sex and the House of Lords and class and eccentricity and one particular one that Sarah, I think, completely has captured, the English capacity for self-deprecation. That's we're going to talk about that in a minute. But anyway, Sarah, is that fair to say that your book is a sort of examination of what might be called clichés, and you wanted to find out if these clichés were supportable in reality?
Well, it sort of came out that way a little bit. When I started writing the book, I thought it would probably be more comprehensive, and it would be a sort of wither Britain in the 21st century. And as I was writing, I found I didn't really want to write that book. I've written a lot in the newspaper about things like immigration and the problems with multiculturalism, and that is worth a whole other book. I wanted to keep a lighter tone and to sort of look, at social issues and look at, behavior. And I wanted to write about things that I find interesting or amusing or worthy of more examination. I have a chapter here about the British and dentistry, which, of course, is a cliche. They have bad teeth, but you can say that, but there's, interesting reasons. And one reason is that they really are, I think, less vain than Americans. It's never been a huge priority to have incredibly beautiful teeth. You want teeth that work, but they don't have to look great. And another, is a more serious issue is the National Health Service is, facing a real financial crisis, and a lot of people cannot get a public health dentist. No NHS dentist will treat them. So I go to a clinic, an emergency dental clinic, and I talk to a guy who had been pulling his own teeth because he couldn't get a dentist. So, I try to go beyond a little bit just the kind of surface of things in the book.
But what's fascinating is that you've taken on, I think, some of the themes that, people have been examining, going, the Brideshead Revisit, I suppose, image of England, and you've examined particularly the cliche of class, and the other institutions and characteristics that you've examined, and you have wanted to find out if there was truth to them. And you've also started to find that some of these characteristics are changing due to your reporting on what's going on in England now. You're finding that certain institutions' characteristics are under assault, like the House of Lords, say, for example, or the right for hereditary lords to occupy a place in the House of Lords. And you've sort of examined shifts in the British temperament, but it seems as if underlying it, you've found that there is this British character, everyone can describe it, that is still somehow intact. And is that fair to say?
I think it is fair to say. I think there is a lot changing in Britain right now. It's become a much bigger consumer culture than it used to be. Certainly when I moved there 13 years ago, it did have a feel, a little bit of a backwater. The stores weren't open on Sunday, and there was no real notion of a service economy, and that's changed completely. The hereditary peers were kicked out of the House of Lords. But, I found when I was doing stories that these themes would develop, and I found, I started doing profiles of people. I get to do pretty much everything, except for I don't have to cover business, which is nice. But, I find, people I found interesting to write about. So, I wrote about Alan Bennett, the playwright, and I wrote about Hugh Grant, the actor. And I found, there were themes that came out of their character that were kind of universal to Brits, and in that case it was this self-deprecation, this idea that here were these people who were had huge accomplishments, and yet they were sort of allergic to saying anything nice about themselves. You know, it's when I first met my husband, who had a really good job as an editor-in-chief of a publishing house. He described himself to me as a drunken, sort of impecunious, irresponsible freelance writer who, you know, did a little editing on the side but wasn't going to keep his job for very long. Similarly, you know, I kept coming up against across these people. You know, there was a guy who won 2 Nobel Prizes in chemistry, and he was interviewed once, and he described himself as just a chap messing about in a lab. When I was writing this book, I met this guy at the library, and, you know, it was very British. We would go to the library, and nobody would talk to each other. You know, you'd sit there for months with the same people and never exchange a word. And we all had to go outside one day because there was a fire drill, or an actual fire. And so we started chatting, and since I'm American, I started asking questions, and I asked this one guy what he was working on. And he said he was writing a book, and I said, God, that's great, that's fantastic. Have you written other books? And he said, yeah, I've written 3 other books, but they're all rubbish. And, you know, when people say that, you don't know, is he actually saying his books are terrible, or does he mean you to think, I'm so secure and so accomplished that I can say that and withstand my own insults? It's very hard to figure out. And, you know, Americans might write off that kind of person as a total loser, but you'd be wrong, because often they're harboring, you know, he probably was like a Booker Prize winner. And this other guy was standing there eavesdropping, and he, in this exchange, you know, I said, surely there's a better way to account for yourself than to say that what you've done is rubbish. And this other guy said, you know, it is just the height of tedium to hear someone banging on about their own accomplishments. And that's so they fool you. You know, they pretend they're just miserable wretches, and they're actually really good at stuff.
Yeah. No, I know someone who really suffered because she sat through an entire dinner party. This was here in LA, talking to this English man who was at the dinner party, who introduced himself as Cornwell and said he was... dabbled in writing,
oh.
and then
John Le Carré.
It turned out to be John Le Carré, and he didn't tell her, and he let her just completely mortify herself and get more and more embarrassed. But I do think that Sarah completely nailed the English capacity for sort of fake self-deprecation, because that's what you were getting at, is that the image of the Brits is, oh, this modest lot, but actually there's this subtext, and what you, in the years that you've been there, have been sort of grasping at is how to get at the subtext or the underlying message. And you seem to, what I loved about that chapter was you seem to have got it, which is jolly annoying, you know, because the point of being English is that that English are deeply duplicitous, and you should all know that. And they don't want to be got. So explain, if you will, what lies behind this self-deprecation, or what do you think does?
Well, again, I think it's just that, you know, they're taught, or you're taught, I'm going to just use you as an example of all English people, you know, taught in school not to brag, not to get above yourselves, you know, always be modest about things. But if you actually are accomplished, it's hard to be, you know, honestly modest. So you have to be falsely modest. And of course, it's part of the sense of humor. You know, it's much more funny to tell stories about how, you know, miserable and you know, ill prepared you are for things. It's like when we were all kids and we would go into exams and you'd say, "Oh, I did so terribly. It was horrible." When of course you knew probably you hadn't. But I think it runs deeper. My husband, again, my poor husband, I always use as an example of things too. But, you know, were he to, let's say, win the Nobel Prize, you know, the best he would ever say about it is, you know, it wasn't bad. He just cannot cope with, you know, blatant self-regard. And I think a lot of Brits can't handle Americans' kind of shiny narcissism. You know, they don't know what to make of people running around and talking about how great they are.
But you have observed, though, that England is slightly modifying in that regard, and it has introduced this kind of affirmation culture where kids, you know, you talk very back to your husband very amusingly about a poetry reading that you go to at a school, and your husband is so appalled because everyone's applauded even when they read really badly.
Well, sure, you know, it's the same way that it is here. It's, you know, that whole thing where the kid's in the playground and you hear the mother say, you know, "Well done for breathing, Joshy." You know, and You know, in the old days, in report cards in school, they would, the teachers would just be blatantly rude and mean to the kids and say, you know, you're hopeless and you'll never amount to anything. And now it's gone way in the other extreme. And a friend of mine actually heard some teachers in our school at sports day saying to the kids, okay, everyone pat yourselves on the back and say, well done, me. and at this poetry reading, it really was, these were young kids, they were all supposed to get up and read these poems. And, you know, they were really bad at it. They were just really young. They would cry, and they couldn't, you couldn't hear them. And we would applaud every time and say how great they were. And my husband, you know, said, it just wasn't like that when I was a kid. You only got praised if you did something well. And he said, why would anyone try harder if everyone gets praised? I think he was just bitter because they were so mean to him in school.
Well, also, I don't remember getting praised. I think it was that you didn't get abuse. If you did well, it was. but now your husband is, and we won't make this whole thing about your husband, but he is quite interesting because your book seems to express sort of bemused frustration at some of these English characteristics you've had to sort of coexist with for your time in England because you went there for love. You met this guy, and interestingly, your husband. He seems to sort of, you know, this is a guy who's written a biography of P.J. Woodhouse. I mean, you couldn't get more English than that. He seems to personify so many of these English traits that you are interested in examining. Is that fair to say?
Well, that's true, and it was sort of annoying about P.G. Woodhouse because, you know, he's a fascinating character and it's a really good book. But I joked with my husband, you know, he picked the one guy in the world who has, you know, less of an emotional life than he does. So that, you know, so the whole point about biography is you're supposed to really examine someone's psyche. And P.G. Woodhouse spent his whole life, you know, working hard to not have a psyche worth examining. So there was none of this delving into, you know, emotional issues. And, you know, the thing about Robert, my husband, is, you know, he has a great sense of humor, and you can really tease him about this stuff, and I feel that's the only way to deal with these people. he was up actually writing the book on P.G. Woodhouse, and he was incredibly focused. Can everyone hear me? I'm sorry, I'm not so good at these microphones. He would come down and just his head would be completely elsewhere. And that's how P.G. Woodhouse worked also. I mean, his whole life was working. So he was, you know, would live in order to work rather than the other way. And Robert gets like that when he works. So he came down and we had little kids and he wasn't helping in the kitchen. And I said, you know, you're just emotionally autistic. And, you know, an American would understand what you meant, an American man, but Robert looked at me and said, oh, darling, you're right, I am artistic. You know, and you really do just have to laugh. What else are you going to do with him?
Now, was he meaning, presumably that was a joke. He didn't mishear you.
No, I think that's what he thought I said. And, it, you know, it made sense to him. An artistic temperament doesn't need to, you know, do the dishes.
But it is interesting what you just said, that he, someone who doesn't plumb the depths of his emotional being, writes about someone who did, you know, did that even less so. And yet, one thing I find really intriguing is your book that's come out this year. You're an American analysing the Brits, but I was sort of checking on Amazon, you know, books about Americans, books about Italians, books about the French, books about the English. There's more books about the English than there are about any of these other cultures. And most of the books are written by Brits. And this is a people that purports to be not in the least bit interested in examination and the psyche and, you know, poo-poos going to psychologists and so on. And yet are busily examining themselves as a people. What do you think is so fascinating about the British that propelled you to want to write a whole book?
Americans are fascinated about the British, but I think you've said something interesting about the British self-examination. I think the British are very worried about who they are. You know, they didn't have to define themselves before because they had an empire which defined themselves without saying. And since there has been no empire, there's been a real sort of crisis of confidence. In the last few years, especially because of, you know, Muslim immigration and Scottish greater independence, the British government, as you know, has tried to force, you know, this discussion of what it means to be British. And they had this exercise a year ago or so. They announced that they would try and formulate a statement of ideals. You know, what are British values? And they kind of went out to the public and said, what do you think? And what they forgot to take into account is that one of British, you know, the biggest characteristics about British people is that they don't want to really define themselves. It makes them irritated when the government tries to tell them, you know, how to feel in this way. And so they started making fun of this proposal. And the Times of London said, well, let's have a contest. You know, let's write a motto for Britain and see. And the government said, no, it's not a motto. And the Times said, well, we're going to do the contest anyway. And some of the entries were things like, at least we're not American. At least we're not French. One empire slightly used. And then the winning motto was, no motto, please, we're British. And the guy who came up with that said, you know, I cannot think of anything less British than having a motto. So, you know, so they're trying really hard. It's, you know, it's endlessly interesting for Americans, obviously, because they're kind of our parent country. And I think we've always been fascinated by you, by them.
Now, the book, there is an undertow of sort of frustration as an American, certainly at some of the deficiencies in, say, service and weather and things like that. But
and that's all your fault too, the weather.
but it's your chosen home. Do you have an affection for the deficiencies at the same time as you disparage them?
Oh yeah, well, you know, it's I'm in such a great position because I look at it as an insider because I've got this whole English family, and then I get to look at it as an outsider because I work for an American newspaper. So whenever anything, you know, is awful, I just think, well, at least I get to write about it. Should I read that little section? Do you want me to?
Oh, absolutely. Sarah has, I have to say, look at this book. I've marked it. These are all pages that made me laugh out loud. It is so amusing, but one of the sections she's going to read about now is, I guess it's English attempts at customer service. Well, satisfaction.
What I'm trying to say in the book is that there has been this explosion in, you know, consumer empowerment, and the government and companies have been trying to, you know, satisfy people's need to actually have things that work and people who help you, and it's still a work in progress. You know, they're trying really hard, but they can't quite get it. And one of the things that happened since I've been there is when you take a train now, for example, and it breaks down. In the old days, you would all just sit there fuming in silence. Nobody would ever come to tell you what was going on. Nobody would ask. And, you know, God knows how long it would be before you get moving again. And now, the trains still break down as frequently as they used to, but they always tell you why. And I swear to God, there's some trips where there's like six different excuses of why they're late. And so I just have this list of excuses. And these are excuses that I've either heard or people have told me about, or I heard, you know, myself, or I read about. I'm just going to read some of them. Leaves on the line. That's the fall, autumn leaf fall. Trees on the line. Debris on the line. Cows on the line. Dew on the line. Horse on the line. The wrong kind of snow. High levels of pollen. Extreme sunlight. Signal failures. Switching failures. Person attempting suicide on the line. Non-arrival of staff. Overhead line problems. Non-availability of rolling stock. A problem with the door locking mechanism, passenger incident, customer incident, operational reasons, boarding flow problems. That's when people took too long getting on the train because it was too crowded, so they had to leave late because they didn't have time. Poor rail adhesion, adverse weather conditions, and extreme weather conditions. Extreme weather is like there's an inch of snow and everything gets paralyzed. Also, because the train had to follow a freight train from York, because the train was held at the station for rationalization, because the train is completely broken down, because children are throwing stones at the train, because of a death at Clapham Junction, because the driver has issues to raise with a single man, because we need to carry out safety checks with some of the track workers, because we've been stuck behind a slow Connex train when they know we're an express service, because the train wasn't getting traction, so a second locomotive had to be got, and this locomotive had to be hired from another company, because a pigeon dropping landed on a vital electrical component, causing a short circuit, because we've run out of fuel. Once my train was idling at a station in London when a woman's voice came over the loudspeaker. If you are the driver, please make yourself known to the staff. Passengers on another train felt it shudder to a halt and heard the conductor say, "Is there anyone on board who knows the way to our destination?" On one train, the conductor informed passengers that they had stopped moving because the driver is only 5 feet 1 inches high and the swivel chair has broken and he's too short to reach the pedals. On another occasion, the windscreen wipers broke, the train could not move, and a staff member said, "If anyone has some nuts and bolts with them, will they please come forward?" And the Daily Telegraph wrote a piece about that and reported, "Willing passengers gathered together a rudimentary toolkit, and one even climbed onto the front of the engine in an attempt to get it running again, but to no avail."
Now, that sort of thing used to drive me absolutely bonkers. I mean, it was one of the things about England that contributed to me just dying to be in America. Does it drive you bonkers, or as a writer, does it just give you more material?
Well, no, the train is fine. You just bring something to read and, you know, settle in for the long haul. No, it's all right. It's really okay, actually.
But it does inspire me to say that you really should tell us about the efforts at a protest. You know, as we know, Americans are much better at getting furious and going and demanding service than the English
are.
Well,
yeah, so these people were upset because every time they got on the train, there was no seat. These were commuters. And sometimes the train was so crowded, they couldn't get on at all. And then the train company canceled a bunch of the trains, so there were even fewer trains. So they decided to protest by not buying tickets. And they printed up these fake tickets that said, destination to hell and back. And they sort of brandished the fake tickets and got on. And one guy dressed as a sardine as a way to, you know, sort of performance art to embody how awful it was. But it was just a one-day protest. And then, you know, Parliament got interested and the Evening Standard started a new campaign, which was quite modest in its goals, which was a seat for every commuter.
But you do have this great line here about your guy who said, "And then everyone else raised their tickets high," he told me later, "so excited with from his small brush with civil disobedience. It was like something from Henry V. And you have to credit the British for their being so literate, even in a time of protest over transport.
Absolutely. It was a very literary protest.
But those observations lead me to another British characteristic that maybe, let's say, with the rise of celebrity culture, maybe slightly under assault, and that's the one of British eccentricity, which you've examined at some depth, and I know you have a great story relating to British eccentricity.
Well, no, and I sort of went into this chapter with what I was talking about, this effort to define Britishness, and, you know, when I look at it, what I really came up with is something that Orwell touched on in one of his essays, the idea is kind of that British seem conformist on the outside. You know, they're a law-abiding country, they don't want to make a fuss, yet deep down they have a real love of liberty, and they celebrate the right of people to do what they want on their own. And I found myself doing a lot of profiles of people who sort of fit this bill, and one guy that I really loved writing about was a guy who was campaigning for the right to go naked in public, and he used to walk around naked in London all the time with just a backpack on, and he got arrested a lot, And he refused to get dressed, and he finally got put on trial. And he became, it appears, the only naked defendant in the history of the British judicial system. And he, his defense was that, well, his he was being accused of insulting people's morals and offending, you know, their abilities to sort of go about their daily life. And he called his witnesses people who had seen him naked and said they had not been offended and they had been able to go about their daily life just fine. And he won the case. It was a great sort of, you know, triumph. And the judge had instructed him, you know, not to get up too quickly, to not upset the ladies in the jury. But after that, you know, he went outside and he had his clothes in a little paper bag. And several of his supporters had come to court and they flung off their clothes in solidarity outside. And he thought he would hail a cab to take him home. And the cab driver pulled up, looked out the window, saw him, and shouted out, "Not on your life, sunshine," and drove away. I wrote about him, and then I sort of was thinking why the British people had such affection for someone like that, and I contrasted it to what happened when David Blaine, the American illusionist, went to London and tried to be kind of willfully eccentric for publicity, and I thought I'd just read a little bit of that, if that's okay. If I can find it. Do we remember what page? Oh, here we go. Okay. Whoops. His plan was to spend 44 days in a see-through plexiglass box dangling from a crane near London Bridge, subsisting on nothing but water. He called his endeavor Above the Below, which some observers considered a bit much. The British were not impressed. They were not impressed when he pronounced his venture the most extreme exercise in isolation and physical deprivation ever attempted, or when he said, "I'm a great artist, nothing more, nothing less." They were not impressed by the multi-million pound deal he struck with Sky Television, and they weren't impressed that he had decided to confine himself to a glass prison and voluntarily starve when so many people were actually incarcerated in real prisons and actually starving. The mayor of London said it was disrespectful to the IRA members who died on hunger strikes in the 1980s. Blaine duly took his place in his box, but the stunt backfired. It was as if it were the 18th century and he was in the stocks. Crowds of cynical Londoners gathered underneath the box and laughed at him. They pelted him with bananas, French fries, and eggs. They made such a mess that his girlfriend, the unusually named German model Manon van Gerken, had to be cranked up on a crane to wash the food detritus off the box with a cloth. "We never had anything like this in New York," she said. Blaine's helpers raised the box so it wouldn't be within egg-throwing distance. A group of men positioned themselves on Tower Bridge and tried to hit it with golf balls. A hamburger van pulled up and began ostentatiously frying onions and other foods, whose enticing aroma was designed to upset Blaine, starving as he was. A man tried to cut off his water supply. Some youths frightened him by shining laser pens into his eyes. A homeless person sat nearby behind a sign saying, "Please give generously. I am attempting 44 days on continuous alcohol alone." Women took off their tops and flashed him. Men pulled down their pants and mooned him. People stayed up all night playing the drums so as to disturb the tranquility of anyone who might be trying to sleep in an overhead box. A radio station urged its listeners to stand in the cold chanting "ding, ding, ding" in an obnoxious fashion. Someone blasted the song "Living in a Box" by the British pop-funk group Living in a Box. A remote control helicopter buzzed by, dangling a juicy-looking cheeseburger on a string. There was unpleasant speculation about Blaine's bathroom arrangements in keeping with Britain's well-known lavatorial obsessions. Blaine's explanation of his plans for his liquid waste, that it would be expelled via a tube leading out of the box, had left the solid waste situation deliberately vague. Adult diapers were mentioned. A radio host took to calling him Nappy Man.
Nappies being diapers.
True, he did have his supporters, including American tourists, regular visitors who believed that they had telepathic communications with him and that he was sending them special signals from the box, people who felt sorry for him, and the paranormalist Uri Geller, who announced, "He has the quality of Rasputin." In The Guardian, Catherine Bennett said that the satirical response to Blaine illustrated the temperamental gulf between Britain and America, because Britons know how to tell the difference between a huckster and a hero.
And what did you think, Sarah? Were you appalled at the British rudeness, or were you impressed at their capacity to make that distinction?
Well, I felt really sorry for him because, you know, you could see his kind of distress up there. But I also thought he seemed like a complete idiot, I have to say. You know, and it really, they really did get to the heart of it, that he really was kind of a poser, I thought. You know, and who really cared if he wanted to starve himself for 44 days? You know, I could do that at home. And that might be me. I'm sorry if there's a lot of Blaine supporters out there. It just, you know, it just, when he did it in that environment, it just, it somehow looked more foolish than if he'd done it in New York, where people would have been more impressed by him, I think.
So do you think some sort of essential British character was revealed in that whole episode that remains intact?
Well, yeah, they're funny and also a little bit childish, I think.
So speaking of childish, this, I think we have to get onto the topic. You can't talk about the English without talking about their sexual weirdnesses. And in fact, Sarah starts her book with the British and their attitudes to sex and sex education. And so I think we're going to talk about that a little bit. Why don't you get us going, Sarah?
Sure. And I start off a little bit by talking about, you know, the allure of British men to American women. I start actually with a little quote from BBC Radio York. It was a quiz show, and the host said to the contestant, "If someone is described as hirsute, what are they?" And the contestant says, and the host says, "Here's a clue. Most men are, and most women would like us to think they're not." Contestant, after a long pause, "Is it gay, Jonathan?" "Just as some women are inexplicably attracted to prison inmates, so others yearn above all for Englishmen. With their thrilling accents, rumpled boyish hair, and ability to make even pointless banalities sound like brilliant repartee. Find one of these, you think, and you'll never be lost for conversation. Madonna, so keen on the genre that she successfully acquired first a strangulated faux British accent and then a real-life British husband, is perhaps the most prominent contemporary example, but there are others. Gwyneth Paltrow married an Englishman. So did Wallace Simpson, and look what happened to her. I have a personal interest in this issue, of course, on account of the fascinating domestic specimen currently at work at home upstairs in his study, which could be the sunniest room in the house, except that he keeps the curtains pulled shut even in summer, toiling away like Bob Cratchit by the weak light of a small desk lamp. But never mind. The point is that while Englishmen present an impeccable facade, capable, articulate, charming, and best of all, ripe for emotional awakening at the deft hands of a clever foreigner, underneath things are more complicated than they appear. There are many reasons, I believe, but we might as well start with their sex education. When I was in sixth grade in New York back in the 70s, our science syllabus included Love and Sex in Plain Language, a paperback bulging with lurid drawings of naked teenagers in the full sprouting bloom of puberty. The lessons themselves weren't very useful. What is it like to have sex with your husband? I remember a classmate asking our horrified teacher. But at least we got an idea of what we were in for. Relegated to single-sex education or shipped off to unheated boarding schools with no girls for miles, my British male contemporaries, meanwhile, were learning either nothing or information so bizarre as to be permanently crippling. My friend John was informed, along with his classmates, that he would soon find a golden seed in his bed in the morning. At the age of 12, the writer John Mortimer was told by his headmaster, "You will probably have dreams, and in the morning you will wake up thinking, what a rotter you are. My advice is to have a very cold bath or go for a run to get it out of your system." Ben McIntyre, a columnist for the Times of London, told me, "My entire sex education consisted of being shown enormous 6-foot pictures of diseased private parts." One of my relatives was sitting innocently in school one day when his teacher said the time had come to talk of sexual intercourse. Oh, goody, he thought. But the lesson consisted of a 15-minute nature video of two racehorses copulating in a field. There were no follow-up questions, and he was filled with anxiety. Were women similarly standoffish?
Was it over that quickly? And was it okay for the man to trot off afterward for lunch and a drink with his friends? It was a long time, he told me, before I realized that you didn't always have to do it from behind. In his memoir, Stand Before Your God, the novelist Paul Watkins describes late 1970s sex education at Eton, taught by the notorious Dr. Twombly, so creaky, vague, and rackety-looking that at first the boys mistook him for an ancient member of the custodial staff, kept on for sentimental reasons. Until then, everything Watkins knew about sex he'd gleaned from a contraband copy of Big Tits magazine that he concealed inside a New Statesman cover. After successfully arriving at the blackboard, Dr. Twombly drew a diagram of a male stick figure lying atop a female stick figure. "Why do you suppose people lie on top of each other when they're having sex?" he barked. And this is Watkins writing. Dr. Twombly drew the answer in the air with his chalk, speaking slowly so the writing would catch up with his voice. "So they can talk to each other." I saw a look spread on Whittingham's face, but it was too late to stop him. "But sir, surely if you just raised your voice a bit, you could do all the other styles and still talk as much as you wanted to." Whittingham spent the next couple of hours on punishment duty, picking moss from between the flint cobblestones on the main school courtyard. And finally, for my friend Ed, it happened when he was 8 and hunting grouse on the moors with his father, an activity that covered a lot of important father-son ground. They were spending time together. They were engaging in an invigorating outdoor pursuit. They were having a heart-to-heart talk. And on account of having to pay attention to what they were doing, or else they might shoot the wrong thing, they could look at the birds instead of at each other. "You'll soon be going away," Ed's father remarked, peering at the potential grouses concealed in the brush. He fired a shot. "Boys will want to interfere with you." He fired again. "Don't let them."
And I love this book, and I think that Sarah really, really nails the English, as I've already said. However, on the issue of sex and the British, I have to sort of chime in here, because I do feel as if it's a very standard perception of the British is that they are sexually repressed, and that Americans, by comparison, are not. And I just want to sort of put out to you the observation that perhaps, with the exception of those men who now might be of an older generation who really did go through an extremely weird public school or private school education, as you've discussed, that actually the British aren't quite as repressed as they are presented. And in fact, you later in your book go on to talk about sex ed at your daughter's school and how there's a bit of a fuss because they're going to use, you know, the vagina word, and some parents are upset. And you make the very funny and correct observation that the British tend to use euphemisms for private parts of the body, and they refer to and the sexual act itself.
My daughter came home talking about front bottom, and it took me a really long time to realize what she was talking about, actually. And I was watching a medical show on TV, and this older guy goes to the hospital and says he's having problems with his waterworks. And it's, you know, he's talking about, I think, some urinary problem, and it's as if it's a utility in Monopoly, you know, like the electric company.
And then you refer to a woman who, or you laugh at the fact that the British can refer to copulation as rumpy-pumpy, and then you talk about a woman, a mother, who says, "Well, I'm a rumpy-pumpy kind of woman myself," or something like that. And it's absolutely true that the British do have all these euphemisms, however, I do think that underlying the British sort of what appears to be a kind of shyness or slyness about sexuality is actually they're sort of having fun with it. There's a kind of bawdiness that, you know, you can trace back to Shakespeare and to Chaucer, but also, and you talked about some of your English friends in New York and their challenges with American women. I do think that there's that part and parcel of what you found about the English is going along with the self-deprecation and not wanting to boast and all of this, and the not having bad teeth, that part of, and you say not wearing deodorant on the subway, we should mention that as well. Part and parcel of all of that is a sort of, I suppose, a lack of vanity whose positive side is actually, in a weird kind of way, a sort of comfort with their bodies. And the whole lavatorial humour, there's a sort of comedic attitude to one's body and sexuality, and there's a sort of comfort with what one has, you know, versus a kind of terrible need for perfection here that results in men taking steroids and women having fake boobs and worrying far too much about their bodies, which I think can actually get in the way when it comes to a sort of a natural approach to sexuality. So I have felt since moving here that the way in which the English are perceived sexually is actually slightly inaccurate, and I don't think it's fully borne out. In the bedroom, you know, I think that how people present themselves and make these funny remarks about Rumpy Pumpy, actually.
See, I just don't think that's very sexy, Rumpy Pumpy. You know? I think it's a way to kind of be removed from it rather than just sort of do it. And it may be California is more, you know, body conscious than New York, where I'm from. I think I would feel a lot of pressure. Everyone's so good looking here, and they're all in such good shape. And one of the nice things about being in Britain is nobody exercises very much.
Right, you know? There you are. That's my point.
You know, I belong to a gym, and, you know, people really, like, half of them look like they're going to have a heart attack on the running machine, you know? And the idea is, you know, do it as quickly as you can and then get up to the top floor where there's a bar. And
yeah.
And that's, you know, kind of liberating. And in a country where it is sort of cold a lot of the time, there aren't that many days of the year you can even wear a sleeveless top. You don't have to work as hard at it. But I, you know, I maintain the euphemisms are just weird. When I had my first child, I rented a breast pump from this company in London where they, you know, you can rent it so you don't have to. Who wants to buy a breast pump? But it was run by these people who were like Mormons. You know, this guy came over in a suit with the breast pump in a briefcase, and he took it out. And, you know, the men here, if you're lucky, you've never had to see one, but it looks like, you know, the stuff they used to milk a cow. And he told me how to use it, which was very complicated, without ever, ever using the word breast, nipple, cup, or even pump. It was extraordinary how he managed to do that. You know, and if you go to a gynecologist, you know, they all wear pinstripe suits, you know, and the last one I went to, while he was examining me, started telling me about the new book he was reading about the British explorer Stanley Livingston. And, you know, the sort of parallels between the internal examination and Livingston exploring Africa were, you know, it's just like he just didn't want to talk about what he was doing. It was too embarrassing.
That sort of, I guess, double speak. Sort of, I guess you could say the same about the British and money, or the British and what they do. You know, they'll find a way of not actually being completely straightforward about the subject at hand.
I think you're absolutely right.
But tell me what, because we're getting near the time where we should throw this open to the floor. As a initially sort of reluctant American moving to England, what do you really miss about America?
I miss the weather. No. You know, I think Americans do have a kind of optimism and a kind of, you know, an attitude that things, you know, are possible. They have a sort of cheerfulness that I do miss. However, when you're in Britain with your American cheerfulness, you can feel like, you know, I feel sometimes like a big, noisy, slobbery Labrador, you know, bounding around, you know, fakely enthusiastic about stuff. So, you know, it's kind of nice to be able to try to have a happy medium somewhere in there.
But don't you think, because partly through your husband, partly through your work, you've sort of landed in quite a well-heeled part of British society. You know, you're sort of spending time in the upper middle class and meeting quite a few of these sort of uptight Brits as part normal. You live next door to an Earl, you know, who still corresponds with you by mail.
No, just a regular guy corresponding. Our neighbours don't like to talk to us much, but they write us a lot of notes. You know, about things like if they're going to paint the front of their house, et cetera. And they, you know, 12 years later call me Mrs. McCrum still. Very strange.
But don't you think there's a slice of British society that's much more cheerful, don't you think?
I think people in the north are incredibly cheerful. Some Scots are very cheerful, but others are less cheerful even than the English. It's a very, and of course you write from your own perspective, and because of my job, I have an insight into a world that I wouldn't have ordinarily, but you know, you can't be as comprehensive maybe as you want. You have to do it from your own perspective, I think. But you're right. You're absolutely right.
Well, it's a great book, and I think it's time to hear from the floor. So I think I'm going to shout out, and a microphone is going to be delivered.
Can we say that it's overboard humility? We say that this overboard humility is prevalent in all classes in Britain, or only certain of the stratification? They do have, you know, class system, which we don't. And also, can it be seen as a very, very witty arrogance?
A witty arrogance, is that
yeah,
what you
said? Yeah, this humility.
I think that's what it is. I think it's a sort of form of arrogance. And the question also was, does it cut across all classes? I think it does. You know, I think it's probably more prevalent the sort of higher up you get and the more accomplished you are. You know, there's something, if you have won 2 Nobel Prizes, you know, there's something kind of, you know, you know, you're not holding yourself up, you know, leaving yourself open to any ridicule necessarily if you say, oh, I was just messing around, because you have your Nobel Prizes at home. You know, no one can say, you're actually, he's right, he is sort of a loser.
Over here.
Do you attribute the derisiveness of the English? Because I think that's sort of at the root of... I don't think it's that they're not vain so much as they don't... You know, they love to sneer at everything. So, God forbid, you announce that you are great at something because you put yourself at risk.
Well, it can be frustrating, and it's not... It's, you know, sneering to some extent. It's also a fear. You know, I think they're afraid of... You know, just leaving themselves exposed. My mother-in-law, who's the most lovely, loving mother, you know, is kind of perplexed and kind of jealous at the fact that I, like a lot of Americans, constantly tell my children, I love you. You know, I just say it. Because that hasn't been a natural thing that in her generation they ever said. So she'll try, and occasionally, you know, I'll be leaving and she'll sort of say, bye, love ya. And she's kind of making fun of me, but also partly saying, you know, I wish I was that easy. So I think, you know, I think there's an uneasiness, but it's not necessarily bad. It's just maybe they're not as comfortable as we are. Is that true?
Do you know where it comes from? I mean, have you figured where it comes from?
I think it's because they're an old... It's a defensive... I think because they're a very old country.
Island mentality, maybe?
I'm sorry, what?
An island mentality, maybe?
Island mentality, very old society. You know, we started as a... You know, we're young, and we started with so much optimism, and they've sort of seen it all over the centuries, and it's prevented them. I don't know. It's one of those things you could debate for years, mm-hmm. And I probably will be.
And the weather doesn't help.
No, and the weather really, makes you kind of depressed,
yeah,
right?
Because English people come to LA and find themselves being cheerful despite themselves. And
I checked into my hotel last night, and the woman asked me what my name was, and I told her, and she goes, "Cool." And that's the last thing you would do, you know, an English person would do. And I'm sorry to talk on about stuff that's not really on the point, but I was, you know, there's a problem in Britain if you go to a cocktail party, let's say, or a gathering where you don't know anyone. It's not customary to go up and say, "Hi, you know, I'm Sarah Lyle." They think it's really weird. And I sort of tried an experiment with a friend of mine once, and I said, okay, you know, the next person who comes in, I want you to introduce yourself. So this guy came in, and my friend stuck out his hand and said, "Hi, I'm Stephen Bailey, pleased to meet you." And the other guy, who was a college professor, looked at him and said, "Is that supposed to be some kind of joke?"
And I was in London, having lived here for several years, and I was wandering around Soho, staying in Soho, because my sister lives there, and got up very early and was walking down Old Compton Street. And as I would in Santa Monica, I caught a stranger's eye and went, "Hi!" And this man looked like he was going to call the cops. I was a loony. Anyway. Okay.
You are far away in that corner.
Well, hi. Well, probably by now you've realised I'm English. And there's a book called Brit Think, Amerithink, which is one of my favourite books. And what I like about that is it's very balanced. And it pokes fun both at the English and American. And I've got to say, and I'm probably going to be really unpopular now, but it strikes me that you've gone to a different culture and a different country, and you've taken an American yardstick, and you've chosen to measure the British by that. And I've got to say, I'm not very comfortable with it. Some of the things I've heard strike me as they're coming from another generation. Or you're just talking about the upper middle class or the upper class, which represents a very small minority of the English. So it seems to me it's almost a little bit rude what you've done. So what's your answer?
That's a perfectly valid point. I'm not sure, you know, maybe if you read a bit more, you might not see it that way. I mean, I say a couple things. I mean, anyone could write a book, a similar book about America. You know, my job is to cover Britain. I don't write about America. And so when people say, you know, you talk about the teeth or whatever, and of course there's a terrible health crisis in America too, and I'll say fair point, but that's not my job to write about that. That's one thing. And I think the other thing is I do poke fun at America too. I think, you know, for example, just when I was talking about David Blaine, I don't think I was trying to be rude about what the Brits were doing. I think I was much more sympathetic. But, you know, anyone would have their own opinion, and I think a lot of people in any culture don't like being analyzed by others, especially because it's always idiosyncratic. You know, it's my analysis, and I can't speak for anyone besides myself. But I think, I hope I've written from an affectionate point of view. I hope I haven't been rude, but, you know, that's okay if you think that.
Oh, I think the book's fairly withering in parts, but but being British, you know, we can take a joke against ourselves, I hope. I think you should take a joke against yourself. But also I would say the British are absolutely notorious at trashing Americans and being full of opinions about Americans without, you know, I've had friends who arrived at LA, they've never even been to America, and they come armed with, you know, verbal assaults on the place, and they've barely even arrived. And I do think that one of, you know, my compatriots' traits is that we're very proud of our own opinions. We really think that we've got it nailed. I mean, Russell Brand? Russell Brand at the MTV Awards, who proceeds to use the MTV Awards as a venue to say, you know, why we needed to vote for Obama, which is all very well, but then to sort of say, I think he went on about how the British was somehow superior in their judgment and this and that, you know, which was bloody rude. let's see, whose hand went up first? Front row, I think.
Yeah. Well, we crumpets are called by various, that's an appellation of various things. Do you feel that that you're more of a crumpet here or in England or here?
What is a crumpet? I mean, apart from the crumpet that I really do like to eat. A crumpet...
It's an appellation for a kind of a female.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry. I thought you were referring to being an expat Brit. I thought that was another word. Oh, no, being a crumpet, a piece of crumpet.
She's very attractive, right? Yeah. She's a total crumpet. Yeah, you're a crumpet. Okay.
There were so many, as we know, so many euphemisms for women. And that reminds me, that's a whole chapter we didn't get to was Sarah talking about the women in the House of Commons, which, you know, would make any remark that might have been made about Sarah Palin or Hillary Clinton to be absolutely so innocent and devoid of that schoolboy sexism that you report on, that I think you also report is diminishing or passing. But how does it feel to be a piece of crumpet?
Oh. How does it feel?
Great. If that's what I am. is that what you mean? How does it feel to be named?
Well, that's one of various names for us as in terms of what our sex is.
Oh,
and in England, and it's different than in America.
Oh yes. Oh,
and what kind of life is lived as a female here versus lived in England as well?
Oh well, that Sarah really gets into this, which is sort of feminism. You know, English women who are independent and, you know, establishing a
career and politics or whatever don't like to refer to themselves as feminists, you know. You have to be. But on the other hand, I would say that the Americans are, you know, for good and bad, take things very seriously, including the rights of women. And I, you know, in England, women got the vote first, and in many respects, women do have quite a lot of equality. But at the same time, that doesn't necessarily mean they've erased a culture where men call women birds or piece of crumpet. But I think that women, perhaps, and I've always attributed it to all girls schools. I've always felt that there's a way of being an independent woman in England that is different from here, that isn't politicized. You can actually be a competent careerist woman and also be still called a piece of crumpet or be wolf-whistled at, but somehow reconcile the two. And not saying that it's a good thing or that that's what one should aspire to, but I think you can be a capable woman without the sort of militancy. And as I say, I really want to say that's not necessarily to be aspired to, because obviously one needs the militancy to accomplish certain things like equal pay and women's, you know, reproductive rights and all of that kind of thing, and more power to the women here that have fought for all of that. I do think feminism, such as it is, takes a slightly different form as an English person. But I do think that I went to an all-girls school and you know, where we wore school uniform, and if I had to pick something I missed from England, it would be that. It'd be that all-girls education that teaches you to not be constantly obsessed with the boy in the back of the class and wearing having the right labels to wear and makeup and, you know, all of that. But you just have fun with your... You make very strong female friends and you do sport and... You have, you know, the best fun you get out of your clothes is to hike your, you know, your regulation skirt sort of 6 inches above your knee, you know, and that gives you tremendous frisson, you know. I do think that's a great thing about English culture, actually, is the women's education, when you can get it in that form.
Maybe two more questions?
There's someone really waving back there. Very vehement.
Hi. I had the opportunity on a Fulbright to teach in England for 1 year, and I taught fourth grade in the Worcestershire area, and the headmaster's name was Mr. Jolly. It was very English, and although they had prepared us at an orientation, and I even bought a dictionary, American English, 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 it was still difficult for me a lot of times when things came up. I knew, for example, that a jumper was a sweater. I knew that an oven was a cooker. And I knew different things. But I remember one time, I was always dressed nicely because I felt I was representing my country. And I thought, this is ridiculous. It's rainy. It's cold. And so I made the mistake of coming to my class one day, and they were looking at me, and I said, I know why you're looking at me, because I'm wearing pants. You know, I never wear pants. And they went insane, because pants means underpants, and that I didn't remember to use the word trousers. So my question to you, and both of you actually, is because there are so many different words for the same thing and they are so vastly different, do you raise your daughters to be bilingual, so to speak?
You answer.
I always use the American words. I hope, you know, it's like someone from Eastern Europe, you know, trying to speak the mother tongue. And they kind of laugh at me and are embarrassed. And my, you know, on the same point that you're talking about, my older daughter, when she was really little, came home one day and said, you know, holding up some clothes, Mummy, are these trousers suitable with this top? And I sort of thought, who's raising you? You know, where did you come from? So, you know, you hope it sort of rubs off eventually. But, you know, but I think they're very, you know, kids like to grow up in the culture they're in. They don't really want to hear your boring stories about how great peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are.
Also, excuse me, when I was there, I had a big map of the United States, and I had them with each state to write down an impression, especially of California, and there was a rumor going around the school that I had a gun in my purse, because I was from Los Angeles, and that was very interesting. They were very disappointed when I got there, because I wasn't blonde, and I wasn't wearing a bikini. But also, one thing that came up, even though I thought I had prepared very much for this experience, was when a student came up to me and said, Miss Zone, Sam pinched my rubber.
And I found out a rubber is an eraser. Pinched means to steal, and I nearly fainted in front of the classroom.
I used to work in a clothes shop when I was a teenager in Bath, in England, where I grew up, and an American came in one day and said, I'm buying some pants for my wife, and she's the same size as you. Could you try them on? And I just looked and think, what is he talking about? So I know the pants trouser thing. Anyway.
I lived in Australia for a little while, and they also have self-deprecation in their culture, and they call it cutting down the tall poppies. And I was friends with a journalist there. He explained to me that not everybody is smart. And he was talking about himself. So he was saying, not everyone's as smart as I am. He said, and there are a few in our crowd who are as smart as I am, but not everyone is. So we want everyone to feel comfortable, so we can't really show how smart we are. But his take on it was that it was to help the social aspect. Do you find that people in Britain are more social because they're self-deprecating?
I'm not sure how to answer that. I just think it's one of those, you know, it's just so part of the humor of the culture. And I think, you know, there is this issue where people who've got raised way above, you know, it's this issue of tall poppy syndrome. They need to be taken down a peg. So people are afraid to do that themselves because they don't want everyone to tease them. And it's hard for kids in school because I think in some schools, you know, I think the way it is in some schools here too, if you're seen to be trying too hard, you're a teacher's pet, you're, you know, you should be kind of looked at askance, maybe. One more.
Do Brits look on our political system with horror or pity? What do they think about it?
Well, here's the issue, and I think I would be interested to hear what you say, but they love our system. You know, our system is wonderful. They love our constitution. They don't happen to have their own constitution. It's not written. It's an accrual of precedents. But they've been, you know, really horrified the way a lot of Europeans have by the last decade. You know, in general, Europe is to the left of America politically. They don't support the Iraq War. And they, you know, they're very, very interested in this election. And, you know, not obviously all of them, but I think most of them would tend to be Democrats if they had a choice. And so, yeah, they're very good, luckily, at separating American people from the American, administration. I think they do. I'm not sure why. You know, they have this legislature where half of it is the House of Lords that, you know, now that people don't inherit their seats, they're appointed by the government, which isn't very democratic to my mind. But they like their parliamentary system, and, you know, they've had it for a really long time, so they're not going to be giving it up anytime soon.
Well, they find the American campaigning, running for election, I think, and so much money. The fact that
they're
so much money, and they're horrified by that, and puzzled by the convergence of the president also being the commander in chief and what that means. And then, and of course, they're appalled. British people, I think I can speak for all British people to say the British are sort of appalled by the theocracy that they see emerging in America. The religious right wing, you know, they just. Yeah. So that element that is so strong now in American politics. But anyway, you're there more than I am now, so.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Okay. Well, Louise, thank you so much for making this evening happen. And Sarah, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Sarah Lyle, author of A Field Guide of the Anglophiles, A Field Guide to the British.
Can I say one last thing? Thank you all so much. And as a newspaper reporter and newspaper lover, it's incredibly nice to be in a city where I can read the LA Times in the morning. God bless the LA Times.
Oh, actually, has everybody heard what's happening at the LA Times? The lawsuit? You better report on this immediately. That some frustrated writers there and editors who I guess have stock options, they have filed a lawsuit against Sam Zell. Yeah. Yeah. We'll be covering On Which Way LA.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.